Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in the next 2.5-hour segments, which constitute For the Record program number 200, we're going to update our ongoing discussion on corporate Germany, and in turn, its sub rosa connection with what I call the Underground Reich, literally a Third Reich gone underground, the economic component of which is the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization set up by Hitler's deputy, Martin Bormann, the most powerful individual man in the Reich, behind the scenes. And Bormann, in order to safeguard the wealth of the Third Reich, itself the culmination of the five greatest capital flows of the 20th century, set up 750 corporate fronts in neutral countries as repositories for the liquid wealth of the Third Reich. Those corporations inextricably link with modern corporate Germany then were the foundation not only for the rebirth, economically and politically, of the Federal Republic of Germany, but also for the continuation of what I call the Underground Reich. The definitive work about the Bormann Flight Capital Organization was done by one of the most heroic journalists of the 20th century and all time. That man was Paul Manning, M-A-N-N-I-N-G, who was part of the CBS News team that covered World War II in Europe, along with Edward R. Murrow. He covered the air war in Europe by training as and serving as a waist gunner on a B-17, covered the air war in Japan by training as and serving as a nose gunner on a B-29, and broadcast the surrenders of both Japan and Germany to the American people on the CBS radio network. His post-war career, because of his work on the Bormann Organization, was deep-sixed, as discussed in For the Record Program 152. If this seems crazy to some people, and I can appreciate to newcomers it might, believe me, the documentation is there. Check spitfirelist.com on the web, or write to Spitfire at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005, and you can get more information about that. Paul Manning's book on the Bormann Organization, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, was published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981, and of the Bormann Group, its relationship to modern Germany and corporate Germany, Paul Manning writes as follows. This, by the way, was written in 1981, so the time frame will be evident. As for Martin Bormann, this now elderly recluse is ever a keen watcher and manipulator in the silent, gigantic struggles among worldwide industrial and financial powers. Atop an organizational pyramid that dominates the industry of West Germany through banks, voting rights enjoyed by majority shareholders in significant cartels, and the professional input of a relatively young leadership group of lawyers, investment specialists, bankers, and industrialists, he is satisfied that he achieved his aim of helping the fatherland back on its feet. To ensure continuity of purpose and direction, a close watch is maintained on the profit statements and management reports of corporations under its control elsewhere. This leadership group of 20, which is in fact a board of directors, is chaired by Bormann, but power is shifted to the younger men who will carry on the initiative that grew from that historic meeting in Strasbourg on August 10th, 1944. Old Heinrich Müller, chief of security for the NSDAP in South America, is the most feared of all, having the power of life and death over those deemed not to be acting in the best interests of the organization. Skipping down, what will not pass is the economic influence of the Bormann Organization, whose commercial directors are obeyed almost without question by the highest echelons of West German finance and industry. Quote, all orders come from the shareholders in South America, unquote, I have been told by a spokesman for Martin Bormann. And with that in mind, we're going to take a look at some of the newest goings-on with regard to corporate Germany, as looked at in For the Record Program 99, entitled Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow and Numerous Subsequent Broadcasts. German corporations differ from other countries' corporations in that they are all part of a preconceived and ongoing plan of national conquest, and whereas other corporations from other countries operate individually and with no coordinated political agenda, German corporations operate much like the air war that NATO conducted in the Balkans in the spring of 1999, where they systematically buy up in order to control various aspects of a country's economy, the only difference, of course, being they don't bomb it. With that in mind, let's take a look at some of what is going on with regard to corporate Germany. The following article is from the Financial Times of London of Thursday, March 9th of the year 2000. By the way, if I sound a little subpar, it's because I still have a cold, and so if I sound a little weird, that's the reason why. Again, the Financial Times of London of Thursday, March 9th of the year 2000. This is an article by Bertrand Benoit, B-E-N-O-I-T, in Frankfurt. It's headlined, BASF Begins 2 Billion Euro Share Buyback. BASF is one of the three giant companies that grew out of the IG Farben Nazi chemical cartel from World War II. This article reads in part as follows. BASF, Europe's biggest chemicals group, yesterday began to return 2 billion euros, or $1.92 billion, to its shareholders in Germany's biggest share buyback program. Given yesterday's closing share price of 45.65 euros, the move could amount to the cancellation of 7% of the group's 621 million shares that give it a market capitalization of 27.7 billion euros. BASF, which has virtually no debt on its balance sheet, said the program would enhance its earnings per share and reduce its shareholder equity, bringing down its cost of capital. Note the lack of debt here. That's going to contrast markedly with American corporations. In the event of an economic collapse, that sets them up for takeover. Continuing. Other groups, including Daimler, Chrysler, and Siemens, have sought authority from their investors to carry out such buybacks. In August last year, chemicals group Hoechst, which recently merged with Rhône Poulenc of France to form Aventis, bought back 1.23 billion euros of its stock. Hoechst is one of the other three companies that grew out of IG Farben, the third being Bayer. Continuing and skipping down, BASF insisted the move would not restrict its ability to make acquisitions. The group has been mentioned as a potential suitor for Cyanamid, the agricultural arm, of American Home Products. And please note that it's already looking to buy an American company. Note the fact that it has virtually no debt, and it's buying back shares in anticipation of acquisitions. Siemens, another of the giant German core corporations, is also doing some restructuring with regard to capitalization, this to prevent takeovers, hostile takeovers, and also to prepare for acquisitions. This from the Financial Times of Friday, February 18th of the year 2000. This is also by Bertrand Benoit, or Bertrand Benoit, I'm not sure which, in Frankfurt. It's headlined, Siemens Investors in Scheme to Deter Predators. It reads in part as follows. Employee shareholders in Siemens, the German electronics and engineering group, have moved to preempt a possible foreign hostile bid. Let me begin that again. Employee shareholders in Siemens, the German electronics and engineering group, have moved to preempt a possible foreign hostile bid. A Munich-based shareholders group said yesterday it wanted to join the Siemens family and increase their collective stake to 25%, constituting a blocking minority to deter predators. The move is evidence of nervousness among German employees following Vodafone AirTouch's takeover of Mannesmann. Unlike many German-listed groups whose shares are concentrated in a limited number of hands, or whose main shareholders are tied to their holdings by contract, Siemens has 90.5% of its shares with unidentified investors, although no individual investor owns obviously more than 25% and can therefore block. A knowledgeable observer would certainly recognize the unseen, at least on the surface, but altogether powerful and deadly hand of the Bormann Group in that 90.5%. If some of this seems facile or like I'm begging the question, it's simply because due to the limitations of time, I have not been able to go into the documentation, or will not during the next 2.5 hours. There are numerous programs available from Spitfire that do. Continuing. About Siemens, which is protecting itself from hostile takeovers, we read the following from the Financial Times of Friday, February 25th of the year 2000. This also by Bertrand Benoit in Frankfurt. This headlined, Siemens on Acquisition Hunt. Subtitle, Germany Telecommunications Group in Talks to Acquire Bosch Mobile Phone Division. We read, Siemens, the German industrial and telecommunications group, unveiled ambitious e-business targets yesterday, adding it was examining a number of partnerships or acquisitions. Heinrich von Pierer, chairman, told a shareholder meeting in Munich that Siemens was negotiating to acquire the mobile phone business of Bosch. It was also considering a partnership or acquisition of Debes Systems House, Daimler Chrysler's information technology business, which is number 2 in the German market. unveiling what it termed an e-business and service offensive, unquote. Mr. Von Pyrer said Siemens would soon generate, actually that would be Pyrer, P-I-E-R-E-R, said Siemens would soon generate one quarter of its sales from internet businesses. Services, he said, would soon account for 50% of its activities. With sales in the first quarter up 12% to 16.4 billion euros or $16.5 billion, and net income before exceptionals almost doubling to 625 million euros, the group revised its full-year forecasts upwards, saying it would generate double-digit revenue growth. And another giant German corporation, one I've spoken about at great length in connection with the Nazi-tracked Serpent's Walk and with German corporate control over American publishing, is the Bertelsmann company last discussed, or most recently discussed, in For the Record program 194. It also is rearranging its situation. It's going to divest itself of much of its equity in AOL, which, as we saw in number 194, it had a lot to do with helping to build. It, in turn, is going to be selling the very lucrative internet properties in order to, guess what, make acquisitions. This from the Financial Times of Wednesday, the Financial Times of London of Wednesday, March 1st of the year 2000. This is by Ashling O'Connor and James Harding. It's headlined, Bertelsmann Reduces Equity Stake in AOL, subtitled Media Companies Drift Apart Following Time Warner Link, and it reads in part as follows. Bertelsmann, Europe's biggest media group, said yesterday that it had cut its equity stake in America Online as the privately held German company scaled back its relationship with its European joint venture partner. Bertelsmann's 5% stake in AOL, bought in 1995 for $50 million, and which at its peak last year would have been worth as much as $10.5 billion, has been reduced to just 0.7%, skipping down. Thomas Middelhoff, chief executive of Bertelsmann, and Steve Case, chief executive of AOL, have been good friends since the Dusseldorf-born executive took a chance on AOL when it was a hopeful startup in the mid-1990s. But the contraction of Bertelsmann's AOL stake suggests that while the personal relationship may continue, the corporate ties are loosening. Skipping down, Bertelsmann said the program of AOL stock disposals, which began in February of 1998, was a strategic move and had no bearing on its holding in AOL Europe. It is thought profits realized from the sale of AOL shares are to be plowed back into the company's own internet operations in a move by Bertelsmann to beef up that side of its business. Skipping down, revenues from all of Bertelsmann's unconsolidated internet activities, which include a 25% stake in European search engine Lycos, totaled 1 billion Deutschmarks in the 6 months to December 31st. As we saw in For the Record program 194, Bertelsmann is engaging in talks with Sony Music to discuss a possible cooperative arrangement or takeover. That is by no means final. If that would happen, that would make Bertelsmann number one in music as well as in English language publishing. More about the German corporate move into American media, that forecast in the book Serpent's Walk as a prelude to the underground Reich taking over the United States in the mid-21st century. Time permitting, we'll talk about that later in the program. The following is from the Los Angeles Times of Thursday, February 24th of the year 2000. This is an article by Robert March. It's special to the LA Times. It's headlined, German Money Makes Its Mark on Hollywood. Interesting pun there. Subtitled, Financing. Independent U.S. Filmmakers Now Lean Heavily on Financial Backers in That Country. This article reads in part as follows. With some traditional financing sources drying up, producers of big-budget Hollywood independent films are crossing their fingers that a buying boom by German companies won't fizzle anytime soon. Fueled by sky-high valuations for entertainment stocks at home, German companies now contribute up to 15% of the financing for bigger-budget Hollywood independent films, about double their support levels of 5 years ago, according to Kathy Morgan, head of the Los Angeles-based American Film Market Association, a group of independent film distributors. Quote, in some cases today, German buyers are putting up 50%, unquote, to secure all European rights, said Morgan, who owns an international film sales company. Again quoting, they have a lot of power in determining what movies get made, unquote. Skipping down. For instance, EM.TV and Merchandising, a TV and film company, is now worth $10.8 billion, up from $35 million when it went public in October of 1997. The company has used its stock for a series of acquisitions, including a deal announced this week to buy Los Angeles-based Jim Henson Company, whose properties include The Muppets, for about $680 million. I chanced to be watching television and was looking at the Martin Short show, and he joked about this particular acquisition that the next Muppet film was going to be entitled Muppets Take Poland, which I thought was sort of ironic under the circumstances. I wonder if he knew perhaps how prescient that joke was. Also indicative of the old phrase by Nietzsche that a joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling. More about German expansion into the United States, German corporate expansion into the United States, and behind that, the Bormann Group and the Underground Reich. This from the Financial Times of London of Friday, March 10th of the year 2000. This is an article by Charles Pretzlick, P-R-E-T-Z-L-I-K. It's headlined, Deal Brings Thoughts to U.S. Expansion. This is about the consummately important deal between Deutsche Bank and Dresdner Bank, two of the largest German commercial banks, which also are linked, as we shall see, with Allianz, the German insurance giant, which, as we looked at in For the Record Program 195, update on corporate Germany, was one of the corporations which was deeply involved with the Third Reich and which is buying up American insurance companies and has yet to make restitution for some of its World War II activities. Once again, from the Financial Times of London of Friday, March 10th of the year 2000, we read, and this again about the Deutsche-Dresdner merger, in case two big acquisitions in 2 years were not enough for Deutsche Bank, some analysts and investment bankers were yesterday turning their thoughts to what might be next. Some regard the acquisition of Dresdner Bank as a move aimed at building a large enough and credible enough financial group to be an equal partner in an eventual transatlantic merger once Dresdner had been satisfactorily integrated. By buying Bankers Trust for $10 billion last year, Deutsche acquired several pieces of the puzzle, a solid trust operation plus the high technology expertise of the Alex Brown Investment Bank. By the way, that particular investment arm is heavily involved with Silicon Valley Venture Capital and plans on being even more so as part of Deutsche Bank, according to articles we've looked at in the past. Continuing. However, Matthew Zeplowitz, an analyst at Salomon Smith Barney, said, quote, with the emphasis on corporate and investment banking, and clearly their priority on ranking in the top 3 to 5 in just about every category, they ought to look to the U.S., which is the one weakish link, unquote. And just why the U.S. might be a weakish link, we're going to look at in a second. Of the Dresdner Bank, Deutsche Bank, Allianz alliance, no pun intended, to which I just alluded, we read the following in the Financial Times of London of Wednesday, March 8th of the year 2000. This is an article by the Financial Times Financial and International staff. It's headlined, Allianz in Three-Way German Finance Deal, subtitled Asset Swap Link to Merger of Deutsche and Dresdner Banks. This reads in part, Allianz, Deutsche Bank, and Dresdner Bank, Germany's leading financial institutions, are close to announcing a banking merger and three-way asset swap that will transform Europe's financial landscape. Tomorrow, Deutsche and Dresdner are planning to announce that they are merging to create one of the world's largest banks, an asset management giant, and European investment banking powerhouse. Simultaneously, Allianz, the financial services group which is a shareholder in both banks, will announce that it is acquiring Deutsche's $120 billion DWS German mutual fund arm, reinforcing its position as one of the world's largest asset managers. The Deutsche-Dresdner merger, in effect a takeover by Deutsche of its smaller rival, is aimed at freeing Deutsche from the constraints of the German banking market, of the domestic German banking market, where its profitability is low, and enabling it to pursue its global ambitions. Note that last sentence. Continuing, the combined bank will be named Deutsche Bank. Allianz, based in Munich, is also to take a stake of about 40% in the new Deutsche-Dresdner combined retail banking unit. And one of the reasons why the previous article that I read referred to the U.S. being a weakish link for a possible takeover by Deutsche Dresdner is that U.S. banks are dealing with a lot of debt. The following is from the Financial Times of London of Tuesday, February 22nd of the year 2000, and I would interject that not only U.S. banks, but much of the rest of the country are in a similar debt-ridden position. The following is by Daniel Bogler and Gary Silverman in New York. This is headlined, "Risky Debt, quote, may cause trouble for U.S. banks," unquote. Listen very carefully to this article. It is a disturbing one, yet very important. U.S. companies and consumers have built up record levels of risky debt that could threaten banks' financial health if the economy slows, warns McKinsey, the management consultancy. Wolfgang Hammes, H-A-M-M-E-S, a senior manager in McKinsey's banking practice, said, quote, "There is a substantial amount of hidden credit risk at U.S. financial institutions that could potentially lead to serious loan losses. Most banks' risk management systems are not sufficient to identify and quantify these risks," unquote. Mr. Hammes says that, in spite of a 9-year economic boom, U.S. consumers and companies are more indebted than ever. The borrowings of the average U.S. household now exceed a year's disposable income, according to Federal Reserve figures. Meanwhile, the debt-to-equity ratio of Standard & Poor's 500 companies has shot up to 116% compared with 84% in 1990 at the end of the 1980s junk bond boom. The consultancy is even more concerned at the rapid growth of riskier types of credit on banks' bank balance sheets. Volumes of subprime lending have grown by 80% a year to more than $100 billion since 1995. Margin debt, about which Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan has voiced concerns, now exceeds $200 billion. By the way, margin debt alludes to buying stocks on credit. The high margin debt was one of the things that collapsed the U.S. stock market in 1929, keying the Great Depression. Continuing, McKinsey also points to the growth of corporate high-yield borrowing, as well as a trend among individuals to take out new home equity loans to pay off credit card debts. One problem is that bank managements are rewarded on the basis of earnings growth and return on equity rather than on the basis of risk-adjusted capital. Mr. Hammes said, quote, "It is possible to generate very high short-term returns on equity, but only if you take on very high levels of risk," unquote. Much of this pressure comes from investors. McKinsey analyzed 200 Wall Street analysts' reports over the past year and found that only 5% addressed credit risk issues. Note the statement that much of this pressure comes from investors. We're going to follow that up in a second. Many banks, for example, are freeing up regulatory capital by packaging low-yielding loans and selling them in the bond markets. But to persuade investors to buy these loans, they generally retain the riskiest tranche. Also, the growing interrelatedness of domestic and international credit markets, combined with the debt leverage of banks, could intensify the credit cycle's swing, leaving many market participants with large and sudden credit losses. And combine the U.S. indebtedness, both corporate and otherwise, and in particular the high exposure of banks, with the following piece of good news. I'm being facetious, of course. The following comes from the San Francisco Examiner's business section of Saturday, March 11th of the year 2000. This is an article by Alan Goldstein of the Dallas Morning News, Dateline Beverly Hills, and headlined, "Internet Stocks Closely Watched." Subtitled, "Links to Economy Worries Observers, High-Tech Frenzy Has Far-Reaching Impact," and it reads in part as follows. The euphoria for Internet stocks is creating a series of imbalances for businesses, according to panelists at a conference on technology and the economy that concluded Friday. Again quoting, "The economy is inextricably linked," unquote, said Martin N. Bailey, B-A-I-L-Y, chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, addressing the disparity between the soaring prices of technology stocks and the lagging performance of so-called old economy stocks. "Traditional companies are among the biggest customers of high-tech products," he said. "If their low stock prices were to lead them to reduce spending," he said, "computer and software makers would be harmed. That is not good news. Bear in mind with regard to the Borman Group that they are also heavily involved with the domestic economy as well. They're also in a position as a result of that to affect what happens in the United States, perhaps pushing us over the brink. I made allusions to a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, Spitfire. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. And there's also a list of and description of the various tapes available on the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Again, that's one word, spitfirelist.com. Also a matching set of descriptions and information on the KFJC website at kfjc.org. Look in the transmissions and public affairs sections. People who wish to communicate with me by email can do so at demory@kfjc.org. demory@kfjc.org. Please do not be insulted if I don't reply. I simply do not have time. We're going to continue with our analysis of corporate Germany and updating same in our next half-hour segment. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.